This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I don't think I'm going in tomorrow, unless there's a problem. I do have a little job that I've got to do tomorrow morning, but I'm doing it pro bono, or free gratis, or something. There's another company that works with K2 in town, and they're wanting to have a little chat about approaches and all that kind of stuff, and it's going to be like 4 hours, and I didn't really feel good about charging my main client for it, so I'm just going to give them that time. We'll do it this one time. It'll be fine. I did get clearance as to whether or not I could come down with my crazy t-shirt and, you know, skinny jeans and all that kind of stuff. They said, yeah, that's fine, so we'll be fine. Aside from that, all is well at work. We're making progress. Just keep moving forward. Putting out forms. This month, we've actually been able to get together a lot of the meetings that we need to have. And so we've actually got a lot of good work kind of loaded up in the queue and ready to go now. So it'll be interesting to see how all this works out. Aside from that, everything seems to be going fine at work. I'm in my final read-through now on Book 8. That's going fine. I started on Monday, and so I'm up to page 125, something like that, of 500. So I gotta see if I can make a significant dent in that this weekend. And if I can make a significant dent in that, then I'm on schedule. Because the next thing is build out of all the files and get the reviewer's copies ordered. And then that pretty much wraps up that. Get the files uploaded, wraps up Book 8, and I can get back to Book 9. Start a read-through of Book 9, hopefully the last week of June. Run through that. Go from there, then we're in another sprint. So, you know, another 8 weeks, another 80,000 words, and then we're starting to build the beta for Book 9. So, but I think I know where Book 9 is going. I'm pretty sure I know where Book 9 is going. So I think we're fine. I think we're fine on that. Family is good, all is well. Had some cute experiences at the Walmart. Probably I have time to tell you this one. It was funny on Friday. A couple of weeks ago, when I was getting Dad moved into assisted living, I was there in my regular dress clothes, and one of my friends there, who's a worker there, older lady, she's just fun. There's several of them that are just fun. She's fun. I was over there getting some stuff, and I may have mentioned this, and I hear calling out behind me, "Hi, kitten." So I turned around and went, "Hey, how are you?" So we gabbed a little bit, went on our merry way, and she was commenting on, she actually said, "Why do you look normal?" And I explained, well, I was going to work. And she said, "Well, you know, you're looking pretty hot today." So I was like, whatever. So we went on from that. And then it was a couple of days after that, I had actually seen a documentary on Hello Kitty. And I thought, you know, this is an amazing graphic accomplishment. And I may have mentioned this last week. I don't know. Stuff starts to blur together after a while. So I went ahead and got myself a Hello Kitty t-shirt. I think I did mention this last week. And some Hello Kitty socks. And so I wore that on Friday. And, of course, it was a hit among the women. They thought it was great. What I didn't see, I saw my friend just briefly, I saw her. I was actually talking to somebody else, and I heard her call out, "Hello, Kitty!" from behind me. And I turned around and grinned, and laughed and she laughed and she went on her way. She was heading out to the lawn and garden section. And so I went on my merry way, and because she looked like she was busy, and I don't like to bother the workers if they're busy. So I had done my running around, was trying to change addresses at the doctor's office and the pharmacy and stuff for my dad, because it looks like he's stable and it's going to happen. And although my dad was not happy today because he had to get his name on a maintenance list for a couple of things. He was like, well, I'm going to have to wait. Right, Pop, you're on the maintenance list. They will get to you when they can. Well, seems like there should just be some way to kind of hurry up the list. Well, Pop, look, okay, there's a lot of other things that have to be done, and, you know, you're just going to have to wait. So he had a blind that wouldn't close, and he was like, well, I can't even get dressed out here. So I just grabbed a sheet, hung up a sheet there for him. There's that he was saying, well, these people don't even know how to improvise. Pop, it's fine, Pop. I fixed it for you. Oh, man. So, yeah, it's funny. Anyways, But got him taken care of. Anyways, so I did a bunch of running around. And it does look like Pop is settling in there. He's going to be content. It's fine. So now I'm changing all the address stuff. And at the same time, I had to loop back to Walmart because I had to meet with a government official because I have a friend who was getting a top secret security clearance. And I had already told him, I think I probably mentioned this last week as well. I told him, okay, I'm going to be there in skinny jeans, crazy t-shirt, crazy socks. He's like, whatever, that's fine. So I'm heading back towards the Walmart about 9:30. I've got my grocery shopping done. I got all that done. I get there about 15 minutes till 10. So I'm thinking, okay, 15 minutes till 10. Got 15 minutes. What am I going to do with this 15 minutes? Because, you know, I kind of like to schedule my time. And the thought came to me, well, yeah, you could park over by Lawn and Garden, swing through. You hadn't really had a chance to talk to your friend, so you could swing through and do that. Maybe you'll run into her there and you can have a little conversation. You're done. I thought, well, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So I pull in at Lawn and Garden. As I'm pulling in at Lawn and Garden, I think I mentioned there was a lady that I had seen shopping for a decade before things lit up with the Star Wars outfit. And, you know, we've smiled and exchanged pleasantries ever since. And so as I'm pulling in, I see her. She's at Lawn and Garden loading stuff. And I usually just see her in the grocery department. So I don't know if she just had something special to get from Lawn and Garden. But I had the thought to park at Lawn and Garden well before I could see who was there. So I thought, well, thank you, Jesus, that's fine. So I parked there and walked by and went, hey, how are you today? And she said, hey, how are you? I said, good, you know. I said, it's Hello Kitty Day. And she said, well, obviously. And she laughed. And I said, well, Uncle Sam Day's coming up 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, Uncle Sam Day. She said, you make me smile. I said, good, have a great day. So, you know, go on my merry way. Go through Lawn and Garden, don't see my friend. So I'm like, well, okay, that's fine. At least I got to see my other friend, so that's good. Good enough. And so then I was swinging through the store, and I thought, oh, I should run by electronics. As opposed to going from by the front of the store, I should just run by electronics, just see if there's anything new there. So I swing back down deeper into the store, and I'm going by electronics. Sure enough, I hear this, hey, behind me. Sure enough, it's my friend. I said, how are ya? So she comes up and I give her a side hug as we're walking. And she's the type that she'll just keep hugging you as you walk along. So, you know, I let that go on for a acceptable amount of time. And then kind of, you know, gave her a little squeeze hug. And then we started walking together. And she said, so I have something I want to ask you. This is the same lady who asked me what I did for a living, which I think I mentioned several weeks ago. And I told her, I asked her, what do you think I do for a living? And she said, hairdresser? And I said, no, I'm an IT consultant. So she said, I have a question to ask you. I said, okay. She said, now, you know, it's a little personal. I said, you can ask me anything you want. I said, it's fine. I'll answer you as best I can. She said, okay. She said, well, I was talking to another one of the workers here, a guy, and he was saying, well, that guy's really different. And she said, yeah. She said, but, you know, he's smart. She said, he's an IT consultant. And I guess they were talking some more, and she said, no. She said, I don't think so. She said, because he has a wife. And so then she kind of paused and she looked at me and she said, so the question is, she said, so when you say you have a wife, is that a she or a he? And I laughed and she laughed. I said, it's a she. I said, I am very heterosexual. She said, okay. She said, because, you know, he was just wondering. I said, no, I'm very heterosexual. I said, I just think this is fun. And she said, yeah, well, it is fun. And so we just gabbed on the way off. But, you know, it's so interesting because all of that creates enough familiarity that I can actually bridge across the gender divide and give women the freedom to smile and to laugh openly and to ask things they might be curious about. And they would not do that to a normal guy. They just wouldn't. That because I'm dressed up a little bit, because I laugh, because I'm pleasant, you know, probably partially because of the hair, all those things, it sort of breaks down some of those barriers. And it gives me the opportunity then to actually get to know people, have real encounters with people, brighten their day a little bit. I consider all that stuff valuable. Because certainly there have been times in all of this that then that opened a door for them to tell me about their life, tell me about some struggles they might be, and allow me then the opportunity to say, I will definitely pray with you about that, and, you know, be sure, you know, and then I check back in. They feel like someone is aware of their presence and existence, and all those things are valuable. So, anyways, fun encounters. This week, I've had some things kind of rolling around in my head. I think I've mentioned in the past about Jordan Peterson. He's really interesting. And one of the things that's interesting about Jordan Peterson to me, I think I've mentioned this, is that he describes himself as a nominal Christian. And by that, he means that he doesn't necessarily, he hasn't said for sure, he doesn't necessarily believe that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world or those types. But he sees in Christianity and some of the precursors to Christianity, he sees a life philosophy that is the most successful life philosophy that has ever been birthed. And he mentions at times that he has actually had people begin to describe themselves as atheistic Christians because they recognize what he's saying about successful life philosophies, and they want to embrace the philosophy of Christ, to take up your cross and follow me, you know, embrace the suffering of life, try to make the world a better place. They don't necessarily want the rest of the supernatural components of it, but they see just in that by itself something of value. And I happened to stumble across, just yesterday, I think, a YouTube video called Jordan Peterson, His Finest Moment. And it was an excerpt from a conference that Jordan Peterson had done on free speech and political correctness, I think it was. And his talk that he gave before it is like 50 minutes long. This is cut down to where it's only 10 minutes kind of right in the center, talking about life and how to relate to life. And it's all along these lines of this idea of how do you relate to life? How do you do something profitable in life? And he has some, you know, interesting ways of looking at some of these things that easily fold into the Christian belief system. And that's interesting to me. So he talks about, so he says, here's the problem. Talking about life, here's the problem. He says, you're oppressed, and you're oppressed, and you're oppressed. And he starts pointing at people. He said, we're all oppressed. He said, we all have different things that are oppressing us. Because he's comparing this to the way the identity politics people are doing with how they classify oppression. And basically, they say, well, anybody who's a part of this group is automatically an oppressor. And anybody who's a part of this group is part of the oppressed. And so, therefore, the oppressors have to stop doing it, make reparations to the oppressed. And that's the only way that life is going to be okay. You know, we've got to implement these class policies, these racist, frankly, policies of grouping everyone in the same container because they happen, you know, to have something in the past that is easily assignable to their group. And one of the points that he... change of address went through for my dad. One of the things that he... indicating in this is that you do have this situation where people are saying, well, you know, white supremacy and white patriarchy is oppressing the entire world. And he said, well, you know, if you really look across the history of white people, you're going to find that we're all oppressed. And we are continually oppressed in some way. You know, he said, maybe you're not as short, you're not as tall, maybe you're too short, you're not as beautiful as you could be. You know, maybe your parent or your grandparent was a serf, because he said, honestly, he said, you go back to your great-grandparents and it's likely that all of them were serfs. Most people were not in the ruling class. You know, these supposed oppressors that we are, we were even oppressed when we were growing up. So, you know, that's an interesting idea. And it's, I think, a good way to look at him. And he said, you know, and you can find all kinds of ways that you've been victimized because of the things that have happened to you in your past, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, in fact, he said, one way to look at this is you can say that the entire sum of human history has conspired to produce victimized you and all your individual pathological problems. And that is a problem. It is a problem. But everyone's struggling under that same problem. And he said the problem with identity politics is that it's not just enough to set up these big races. Then you have to fractionate things. So you have to get into intersectionality, it's called. Well, I'm not only black and oppressed, I'm black and a woman and oppressed, and I'm black and a woman and a lesbian and oppressed. And he said all of a sudden everybody has different levels on the oppression scale simply because of what are the characteristics of my life. And he said, you know, this ignores all the fact that the free market system has actually found a way to combat against this, and that is it fractionates people all the way down to the level of the individual, and it says, yeah, you've got a lot of problems, you're oppressed, all that kind of stuff, but you get the chance to figure out how you're going to take all of that, bundle it together, and try to offer a service that somebody else might be interested in. And so he has, you know, he doesn't think that capitalism is the best thing that's ever been invented, he said, but it's a whole lot better than anything else that's come along. So, you know, that's it. And he said, as part of that, then, what we're really talking about is pick up your suffering and bear it and try to be as good a person as you can. Don't make it worse. And he said, you know, there's going to be some people that are going to be awful to you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He said, there's plenty of reasons to be resentful about your existence. You know, you're going to die. Everyone around you is going to die. And there's going to be a fair amount of pain along the way. It's going to be unfair. And it's no wonder you're resentful. And you want to just act it out and see what happens. He said, but if you act it out and just complain and complain and complain in life, he said, you'll see what happens. He said, it won't be bad. It won't be good. He has this phrase, and he said, and infinitely worse, there's this idea that hell is a bottomless pit, and that's because no matter how bad it is, some stupid blankety blank like you is going to figure out a way to make it a lot worse. So, You know, he said, the fact of the matter is you can keep whining about your suffering, or you can get yourself together so that when your father dies, you're not whining away in a corner and you can stand up and help plan the funeral and actually give the people around you some benefit. You know, I mean, this is all, you know, it's just recognize your suffering, pick it up, do the best you can do. And he said, in that process, he said, you're going to find a little light. And then in that light, you're going to see a little bit more of what you can do. Make yourself a little better. He said, you know, you're a fixer upper if ever there was one. And when you get to figure out how well you can figure out, and he said, when you've got that figured out, he said, well, maybe you can figure out how to get along in peace with your idiot brother. So it goes on and on and on and on. And he said, you know, he said, because life is hard. He said, people just think, oh, we're just going to go out and fix society. He said, but society is complex. And he said, when we teach our children that they can just go out and fix things, it's like, yeah, go out and fix a military helicopter and see how far you get. He said, you're like a chimp with a wrench. Whack. Oh, look, it's better, except it's not better. And this is where, you know, it's interesting because he gets down to the point where he talks about just satisfying your desires and how that's not going to work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, frankly, he said, I'm stunned every day when I go outside and it's not riots with everything burning. He said, I knew this guy who had been in a motorcycle accident. He said, it really ruined him. He said, he was a linesman working on the power lines. And he was working with someone who had Parkinson's disease. He said, they had complementary inadequacies. So the two of them could do the job of one person. So they're out there fixing power lines in the freezing cold, despite the fact that one is three-quartered wrecked with a motorcycle accident and the other has Parkinson's. And he said, people are doing this all day long. They're out going to their jobs that they don't like. They're doing their jobs. And he said, look, he said, it's a miracle. The lights are on. The lights are on. And he said, we've got these ungrateful college students, the postmodern types. They're so ungrateful. They don't know. And they're surrounded that they're surrounded by, quote unquote, bleepity bleep, miracles. It's just the miracles that this stuff works. And all you crazy chimpanzees who don't know each other can sit in a room for 2 hours sweltering away without tearing each other apart, because that's what chimpanzees do. So it's fun. And he said, you know, he's always been interested and stunned by all of this, that it could work this well. And he said, I started making videos. And he said, I tried to get to the bottom of some things. And he said, as he thought he got to the bottom of some things, he said, I got this idea about what you might do about it. And he said, it wasn't my idea at all. He said, it's an old idea. It's far older than Christianity. He said, it's the oldest story of mankind. That you can transcend your suffering and see if you can find some hero. See if you can be some kind of hero to make the world that's less awful, et cetera, et cetera. He did mention in here as well, he said, there's a reason, I skipped over it somewhere, he said, but there's a reason that the archetypal, he didn't call it hero, he called it archetypal somebody, a really important person in history is someone who was nailed to a cross. And he was obviously talking about Jesus. So all of this is just really fascinating to me because he does talk about the malevolence in our lives and, you know, trying to struggle against that. Because when he talks about all that stuff, of course, I have a hammer, and to the guy with the hammer, all the world's a nail. And so I just like, yeah, you're right on the edge of flesh and spirit here. In fact, you recognize the flesh side of it, but you're not really recognizing the spirit side of it. But that's okay. You're recognizing the flesh side of it, and even that's beneficial. And even people who call themselves atheistic Christians, if they recognize the work of the flesh within them and they start ignoring it because they have the power of free will, that's beneficial. Now, what was interesting is as I was thinking about all this, I was having breakfast with a friend on Wednesday, yesterday. Well, he was having breakfast. I was watching because I was fasting. And as I was talking to him about all this, this idea flashed in my head, and I started asking them this question, started going down this track that I had never really thought about before. And when I finished, he said, well, that's interesting to think about. And maybe I should have told him, yeah, well, that just popped into my head a minute ago. But I didn't, but we continued to discuss it because there was a moment to discuss it. And in line with that idea, I went back last night just for grins and giggles. Went last night and I went through the Gospel of Mark. And I just made some notes about what was happening in the Gospel of Mark with a specific exclusion. So let's just quickly read through a synopsis of the Gospel of Mark with this exclusion. And then I'll explain my reasoning. So, chapter 1, John the Baptist. He's coming. I baptize you with water. He'll baptize you with the Holy Spirit. So, Jesus is baptized by John. Jesus goes into the wilderness. Jesus calls his disciple. Goes to Capernaum. People are amazed by his teaching. But when the man with the unclean spirit cries out, nothing happens. Jesus doesn't heal Peter's mom. He goes elsewhere. He doesn't heal the man with leprosy. He goes out to the lonely places and people still come out to see him. Okay, chapter 2. Jesus doesn't heal the paralyzed man. He calls Levi, and he eats with sinners. The teachers of the law get mad. Jesus, your disciples don't fast. Teachers are upset. Jesus says, you know, Jesus' disciples eat on the Sabbath. Pharisees are upset. There's an argument. Chapter 3, Jesus doesn't heal the man with the shriveled hand. Crowd follows Jesus, but he doesn't heal any of them, and he doesn't cast out any demons. Teachers claim he's possessed by Beelzebub. Jesus argues with them. Jesus insults his brother, mothers, and brothers, because he did do that. I don't know if you remember. They came to say, hey, you need to come home. And he said, who is my mother and brothers? Because it ain't you, if that's what you're trying to do. Chapter 4, Jesus tells the parable of the sower. Jesus tells more parables. His disciples don't understand. They go over to the other side of Galilee, barely make it over there because of the storm that Jesus doesn't still. Chapter 5, Jesus doesn't heal the possessed man. Pigs don't die. Jesus goes over to the other side, but doesn't raise a girl, dead girl, or a sick woman. Doesn't raise a dead girl, and he doesn't heal a sick woman. Chapter 6, Jesus goes home. He teaches, but they don't appreciate him and take offense. He sends out the 12. They don't do any miracles. But if any don't receive them, they shake the dust off their feet. John the Baptist gets beheaded. Jesus doesn't feel the 5,000, and some faint on the way home. Jesus doesn't walk on the water. The disciples have to come back and get him in the morning because he sent them on ahead, and he's not there, so they have to come back and get him because he didn't walk on the water. Everyone comes out to see him, but no one is healed. Chapter 7, Pharisees are offended that Jesus' disciples don't wash. Jesus argues with them. Jesus doesn't help the Syrophoenician woman. Jesus doesn't heal the deaf and mute man. Chapter 8, Jesus doesn't feed the 4,000. Jesus tells his disciples to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. He doesn't heal the blind man at Bethsaida. Peter says Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus tells his disciples he's going to suffer and die. Peter rebukes him. Jesus rebukes Peter. Jesus prescribes the way of suffering as the way to life. There's Jordan Peterson's thing right there. Chapter 9, Jesus isn't transfigured. Doesn't heal a boy with an impure spirit. Predicts his death. Again, disciples tell someone to stop driving demons out because he isn't in the club. Jesus tells them to leave the man alone. Jesus says they should be careful not to cause children to stumble. Jesus argues with the Pharisees about divorce. He rebukes the disciples for withholding the children and blesses them. He talks to the rich young ruler and tells him to give up everything. Jesus talks about his death a third time. James and John want places at his side. Jesus asks them to suffer. Bartimaeus isn't healed. Chapter 11, Jesus comes to Jerusalem for the triumphal entry. He clears the temple, but the fig tree isn't cursed. The Pharisees question Jesus' authority. Jesus tells the parable of the tenants. Religious leaders get mad. This is chapter 12. They test him about taxes. They test him with marriage in heaven. They test him with the greatest commandment. Jesus talks about the Messiah. He insults the religious leaders. He says the widow gave all she had. Chapter 13, Jesus says the temple is going to be destroyed. Some will come to see. You need to be vigilant. More bad things are going to happen. No one knows when. Chapter 14, Jesus is anointed with perfume. Judas gets mad because of the money. Judas goes to the religious leaders to betray Jesus. Jesus has the Last Supper with the disciples, but he doesn't predict what Peter or Judas are going to do. He goes to Gethsemane. He gets arrested. He's convicted. Peter disowns Jesus. Jesus goes before Pilate. He's beaten. He's crucified. He dies, and he's buried. Chapter 16, there is no resurrection. Now, that's what the gospel would be like, and this is what I told my friend. Imagine what the gospels would be like if there was no supernatural. Basically, it all comes down to Jesus arguing with the religious leaders, offending the crowds, offending his disciples from time to time. And that's it, if there is no supernatural. Now, when you look at Jordan Peterson, and when you look at atheistic Christians, that's what you get. You get people who, as Pastor Burris used to say, are in the white knuckle club. They're just holding on for all they're worth, and their efforts do pay off. They hold on, they hold on, they hold on. They just keep struggling, try to get a little better every day, try to do a little better. Except that when Pastor Burris talked about it, he wasn't talking about Christian atheists, and he wasn't talking about Jordan Peterson. He was talking about Christians. Because again, if you're trying to live a Christian life in the absence of the supernatural, pretty much all you're left with is arguing and struggling. And this is the really sad part. One of my beta readers had made a comment on book 8, because at the end of book 8, I started filtering in this idea of the flesh, the little tyrant. And I had one of my characters say, specifically, I'm not talking about the devil or demons. And this beta reader said, but you really are, in his comment. And I wrote him back and said, no, I'm really not. I said, Paul talks about the works of the flesh. And I quoted the verse for him in there. I said, and in my mind, this is the primary battle that we face. We face this battle between the flesh and the spirit. And I eventually then sent him the text of Still Whispers so he could investigate more. Because he wrote me back and he said, that's really interesting what you said about flesh and the spirit, he said, or the flesh, he said, I'm going to have to think about that more. And so I sent him the book as a way to say, hey, here's my viewpoints on this. Okay, this is a fine Christian young man. He's in his 20s, fine young man. Never heard about the struggles between the flesh and the spirit. And, you know, we can have all the teaching in the world. We can have all the sermons. But if we aren't connecting people to the breath of the supernatural, that's really sad. Because what we're ending up with is exactly the same thing that we would end up with if the Gospels didn't have the supernatural in them. It's a lot of arguments. It's a lot of disagreements. It's a lot of petty misunderstandings. And I know I've mentioned on these podcasts before how it is a quest and goal of mine to get to the place where the supernatural is like air, just as Jesus was. Because Jesus seems to give us every indication that it is our birthright. I know people have a lot of ways to cop out of that. Well, he was God, but he said greater works that you will do than I have done. Well, that was numerically because there'll be more of us. No, no. Okay, you can try to redefine that, but if you just take it at face value, Jesus says that we as his disciples should be able to raise the sick. We as his disciples should be able to raise the dead. We should have words of knowledge. We should be able to walk on water. We should be able to call out to the storm and cause it to still and feed the 5,000. Because that's the gospel that Jesus preached. That's the true gospel. And I'm working on that. And I wish I was farther along than I was. But there is one thing that I'm convinced that I am farther along on, and that is having the supernatural ability to hear, to get quiet enough that I can hear. And what you find when you get there is that it isn't all about huge, important, big things that you're hearing, although God does help with that, and he helps you to make sure that out of the, you didn't even know what you were working to, but he actually helps you to end up getting $3,000 a month for your dad so he can live in assisted living. And I'm really hoping that's what happened, because I'm waiting for the next $3,000 to come in, which will be in a couple of weeks. I'll let you know. Because that's a huge thing. But the voice of the supernatural exists for far more than just that. I'm absolutely convinced it also exists for things like, I'm going back to Walmart. I've got 15 minutes to kill. It would be fun to see my friend again, who I really didn't get a chance to talk to. And the voice of the spirit says, why don't you park over by Lawn and Garden? Okay, great. Oh, hey, and I get to see that person. And now why don't you duck down and go buy electronics? Okay. Oh, hey, and there she is. And we get to talk. When that stuff happens to you over and over and over and over again, but there's stuff you cannot control, and yet you know ahead of time, that that stuff's out there. When that stuff happens over and over again, it creates a sense of wonder within you, moves you out of the white knuckle club. Because it demonstrates this amazing thing that there is beyond you and beyond creation, some coordinating force. Whether you want to believe it's God or not, that's fine. But there is this more out there than just scrabbling along, grinding out every day, suffering, trying to figure out how you're going to make the world just a little bit better place. And what you end up with is joy and abundance. Looking forward to what's coming next instead of dreading it. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.